Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the past decade, hundreds of thousands of American service members have come back from Iraq and Afghanistan bearing the bloodless wounds of post-traumatic stress disorder. Now their spouses and other family members have their own PTS battles. It falls on them to support and care for loved ones who return home as different people, moody, distant, even violent or suicidal. The military now realizes the caregivers must also be helped. This hour on Point, military spouses and PTSD. You can join the conversation, military wives or husbands or parents. Do you live with someone with PTSD? Have you struggled along with him or her? What's it been like? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. On our website, you can find some links to resources for service members and families dealing with PTSD. We'll hear this hour from two military spouses on the front lines of this struggle. But first, joining me from Washington is Army Colonel Charles Engel. He's a psychiatrist, and he directs the Deployment Health Clinical Center at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. He has set up a pilot program there, the Spouses and Significant Others Support Group. It's for family members of military personnel affected by PTSD. Colonel Engel, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Good. Also with us in Washington is Victoria Bruner. She's a social worker, registered nurse, and an expert on combat post-traumatic stress. She's the director of the Spouses and Significant Others Support Group. Victoria Bruner, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. Colonel Engel, let's talk first about some numbers. Does the Defense Department have an official estimate of how many service members are suffering, from PTSD?
Well, I think there's various estimates that have come forth from the Department of Defense, as well as from the from various agencies, including the Army and the other services, looking at the incidence and prevalence of post-traumatic stress disorder and all of its complications in service members. And it's a, you know, sort of a complicated figure to come to because, you know, we can count the number of people who've received care. That will tend to be an underestimate because there's a lot of folks out there. We know from early estimates in the conflict that in the year prior, that those affected, only about a fourth of those have actually received care for their disorder. So, you know, any estimate based on care is likely to be low. Studies from scientific studies, epidemiologic studies, would suggest that between about 10 and 20% of service members coming back are having problems, and you know, depending on how you'd like to do the math, we've deployed over 2 million men and women to this conflict and returned them.
We're talking possibly here then hundreds of thousands of service members who may have symptoms of PTSD.
I think that's right.
How many programs are there? And that's not even talking about the spouses, which is what we're going to focus on today. But what's been, in your judgment, the adequacy of the response, the treatment available for people with PTSD?
Well, I think that we've, from the very beginning, put forward the best response that we can. We've tried to, while fielding the best immediate response that we can, have maintained a learning posture and a caring posture, trying to do better and knowing that we'll have to do better as the conflict goes on. I think to date there's been a myriad, you know, literally hundreds of programs for service members mainly, but also for their families. And you know, I think one of the challenges that we've had actually as a mental health community in the military and around the military has been not the number of programs, but actually trying to create some coherence around them, some sort of general strategy.
But it's safe to say, right, that there is a huge unmet challenge out there in providing services, treatment for people with PTSD coming back from war zones or their spouses.
I think that's safe to say that, we're constantly learning. And to some degree at this stage of the conflict, it continues to shock me anyway that, that we learn lessons, even though we're 10 years in. You would think we would know these lessons, but the nature of the beast is we got to swallow hard sometimes and learn the lessons as they come and respond to them. And we continue to do our best to do that.
And how did you conclude? Now, you're credited with setting up this pilot program. How did you conclude that spouses of soldiers or Marines need help on their own?
Well, I think we've been doing this at the Deployment Health Clinical Center, the center that I run, a DOD center under the Defense Centers of Excellence for Psychological Health and Traumatic Brain Injury. We've been doing this really for about 15 years, and dating back to the 1991 Gulf War, in which the concern at the time was this thing that people called Gulf War Syndrome, which was essentially a collection of physical symptoms, fatigue and pain and often depression and anxiety mixed in with that. We, in those early days in the 90s, we involved family members readily right in with the treatment that we were doing. It was much less complicated sort of situation in that sense. In the post-September 11th era, where post-traumatic stress disorder and other emotional sequelae became very prominent, it became much more difficult to involve family members directly in the care because often there was, domestic disputes and problems in relationships, even a history of violence, a variety of very personal things going on. To involve people, the families directly in the care just became really not feasible most of the time. So we needed another way to get it done. And that's, in talking with the folks that were going through our programs, this was the way that that we went, and I really would have to credit Victoria for being a big part of creating the program and setting it up.
And Victoria, you're now directing this program, Spouse and Significant Others Support Group. I'm curious, Victoria, we've been talking about PTSD as if it's only the people who are deployed, the service members who are deployed who actually have PTSD. Would you say in any sense that the spouses that you have dealt with in this program themselves have PTSD, even if they have never been deployed?
Absolutely. And in fact, many of them are mystified by looking at their spouses when they return and realizing that's not the same person that I knew when they left. There's a lot of important literature on the burden of caregiving and also, most especially, on secondary traumatization. We know that when the service member is deployed, the family also goes through a significant deployment, and they are then responsible not only for the home, for themselves, for keeping the family together, but remember they're also waiting in usually anxiety. The stakes can be very high when you deploy someone you love to a war zone. And so we've known that their fears, their sacrifices, their demands are tremendous.
Right. And you're talking about anxiety, you're talking about fear, you're talking about the demands on them. Those are precisely the factors in a war zone that lead to conditions of a traumatic stress disorder. So what you're saying is that even though you're back on the post somewhere, you can be experiencing in some way the same conditions that your spouse who's deployed is experiencing.
That's correct. And, we have utilize many reservists, National Guard families. They do the best they can to create cohesion, but many of them are living in areas where they may not have access to services and to the sort of support that can really provide a lot of insulation. We know that social support is one of the most important factors in prevention of stress and traumatic stress especially.
Well, Victoria, what are the symptoms that you deal with, that you see most often in dealing with spouses of deployed service members?
Well, many of them are pretty much in a state of overfunctioning. They really don't have much time for themselves because they're really trying to take up the slack and function in two roles. They often express that they have the weight of the world on their shoulders. They're fearful. They are walking on eggshells. They have a sense that they really can't rest. They're waiting, many cases, for that knock at the door, perhaps, that their loved one is not returning or that they have been seriously injured. They may not have the sense that they can really speak up because, you know, military families are very strong. They're very resilient. And they really have an expectation placed upon them, too, and they do, for the most part, function very, very well. But when their loved one comes back and they have this sense that they lost the person that they married to the war, there may also be for them a sense of stigma. How can I let other people know that my loved one is suffering with what we call as the bloodless wound? The so-called invisible wounds of war. And I think most service members and their families, to some degree, are going to experience that kind of distress.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the husbands, wives, and other family members of those affected by PTSD. You can join the conversation. Listeners in the military, have you experienced PTSD? Have your spouses and family members experienced it, and how have they coped with it? You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio, where we've also put up some links to resources for service members and families dealing with PTSD. We're joined this hour by Victoria Bruner, director of the Spouses and Significant Others Support Group program at Walter Reed, also by Colonel Charles Engel, who set up the program. And in a moment, we're going to be talking with two spouses, two Army wives who have taken part in this program. But before we go to them, Victoria, can you just talk a little bit more? You were talking at the end of the last segment about what you see, the symptoms that you deal with. How do women experience PTSD or the issues associated with PTSD in their spouses? Sleeplessness, anxiety. What are some of the clinical symptoms that these women present?
Well, you know, the paradox here about the symptoms are actually that they are very adaptive in the war zone. When the service member comes back, they may still remain in a state of hypervigilance, suppression of emotions, sleeping with one eye open, frankly, very bonded tightly to their unit because the survival of their unit depended on that. So the experience of the significant other or the spouse is that their loved one is coming back, they just can't automatically reset all of those important adaptive, what we would call symptoms related to war zone traumatic stress syndrome. The service members themselves throughout the years have said to us, can you help our spouses and our families really understand why it's so hard to give up those defenses? They have the experience of perhaps a stranger coming back, someone that they love, but they can even sense in their eyes that this is a different person. Many times, too, the service members may not want to describe fully their experiences to their spouses because they're difficult experiences in war that they have gone through. So there may be that sense that their loved one is shut down, that they're not communicating, that they're not present, they don't sleep well. And so what appear to be these really mysterious symptoms can all be actually addressed well.
Well, let's speak now with two women who have experienced firsthand exactly what you're talking about. Joining us from Fort Riley in Kansas, first is Sherry Hall. She attended the Spouses and Significant Others Support Group's meeting in January. Her husband, Army Major Jeff Hall, experienced PTSD after returning from his second tour in Iraq. And they have two daughters, aged 19 and 17. Sherry, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yes. And Shamel Dancy is with us as well. She attended the group's meeting in January and returned as a peer facilitator in May. Her husband, Army Specialist Marcus Dancy, who's now temporarily retired, suffered also from PTSD after returning from Iraq in 2008. They have two daughters aged 6 and 1.5. Shamel Dancy, thank you for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Sherry, I want to talk to you. Your husband, Jeff Hall, quite courageously agreed to sort of be a spokesman for returning servicemen who are suffering from PTSD talked about his experience in a video that was prepared by the Defense Department. We're going to play here just a short segment of that video where your husband talks about what it was like to come back to you and your two daughters.
The impact on the girls, when I came back, I became more and more distant. I used to do everything with them. That all ended. That was not important to me anymore. I didn't want them to be part of what was going on with me. I looked at my bike to just get away from everybody. So I'd get on it, and I would literally ride 1,000 miles. My back would just be killing me by the time I got off, but I didn't care. It's the further I could go. If I could have drove it into the ocean at that time, I would have.
Well, Sherry, I'm sure you remember those times very well. Can you tell us what it was like for you?
It was really hard to watch that after knowing Jeff for over 20 years. We were high school sweethearts and married in 91, and so we've been together for quite a while, and he was very active in our family and was always there for the girls and for me. And he just became very distant. I encouraged him several times, to get help and things like that. But it took him 2.5 years after his last deployment to kind of stand up and say, I'm hurting and I need some help. So it was really hard. It was really a strain because I couldn't explain to the kids what was wrong with him. And I couldn't even really explain it to myself.
Well, he didn't want to explain it to you either, did he?
No, not really. He didn't really want to, let me know exactly what he'd been through. I knew there were some incidents, he talks about those in the video also, that affected him greatly.
Incidents where he lost members of his unit.
Yes.
And that affected him very much.
Yes,
right.
It did. But we didn't really talk about that too much because I don't think he wanted to really share everything that went with that.
And what was your family as a unit was really jeopardized during that period, right? Can you talk about that?
The deployment or?
No, when he came back during this time when he just wanted to get on his motorcycle and ride and not share anything with the rest of you.
Yes, he was suicidal. He would tell me a couple of different times, just take the kids and just go, leave me alone. I just want to be alone. I don't want to live anymore. Just things like that, and I became very, very afraid. For the first time, even through two deployments, I never feared for his life. But it was at that point where I was afraid. Vic talked about not sleeping. I didn't sleep for several weeks because I was afraid he would get up in the middle of the night and either leave or take his life.
Oh my goodness!
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I was really afraid for him.
And Shamel, your husband Marcus was with a quick reaction force in Iraq, which we all know involves situations or often involves situations of great danger and stress. And I think that you've said that he had to go on a lot of missions outside the perimeter of his base to communicate with people. That had to be very stressful for him.
Yeah, it was. And he would talk about it a little bit while he was there. But because of the sensitivity of the situation, I didn't find out about a lot of the things that he had seen or experienced over there on those missions until he got home. I'm still finding out a lot of the things that he's seen now.
He didn't want to talk about it either.
No.
Yeah. And how did it? How did you experience? You saw that he was having all this stress on his return. What kind of issues or problems did that present for you and your kids?
Well, the distance, because just like in Sherry's situation, Marcus was very involved within the family. But then when he returned home, he just became very distant, just wanted a lot of time to himself. And, you know, your kids start to realize, you know, something's wrong. Daddy wasn't the same way he was. You know, when we put him on the plane, he was Daddy. And when he got off, he was somebody totally different. So it did take effect a great deal in our family. His night terrors, the mood changes, depression, anxiety, and he was also suicidal, and there were times where I was just afraid to leave him alone because I was afraid that he would take his life.
Now, I know when your husbands were deployed, you Army wives, especially those of you who lived together on a post, would find a lot of solidarity among yourselves. How was it after they came back? Were you able to reach out to other wives for the same kind of support that you found when all of your husbands were deployed, or was it different? Was it more difficult?
For me, after Jeff came home, about 6 months after he came home, we changed duty stations. So all of us that were together, we kind of scattered. Right. Everybody changed duty stations at that time. So, and, you know, we tried to stay in contact, but our lives get busy with other things going on. I thought I was the only one who had a husband who was dealing with this. So for me to go talk to somebody, you know, else whose husband had been through that even at our new duty station was a little hard for me because I just felt like, well, they look like everything's okay. It must just be Jeff. So that's how it was for me.
Yeah. And Shamel?
I experienced the same thing. I often said that a lot of times living on post, we all come outside on our manicured lawns and we wave at our neighbors and we go back inside, but we have no idea what's going on inside that household or what's going on with that soldier. And I felt like I was the only one as well, that there was no one that I could talk to. And all of my friends are not military affiliated. So they could empathize with what I was going through, but they couldn't fully understand with what I was going through and what I was feeling. So I didn't find a lot of resources out there for me, and I was kind of afraid to look because I felt that whatever he was going through was, if anyone else was experiencing what Marcus was going through, it was, you know, a big secret, and no one really wanted to talk about PTSD.
Well, I can tell you that many other families were, in fact, dealing with this because our telephone lines have really lit up here. Let's go first to Joyce from Springfield, Massachusetts. Hello, Joyce. You're on the air with On Point.
Hello. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Well, we're surviving the whole PTSD thing, especially in a National Guard family, has been very difficult. My husband was in Anbar Province, and well, for most of his tour, and the last 3 months were in Baghdad. When he came home, he not only had PTSD, but he also had TBI. And
traumatic brain injury.
Yes, yes, non-combat related, but, you know, it happened on the FOB there. You know, when he came home, he was very different, very withdrawn. And, you know, a lot of our friends didn't understand. And some people have made comments, well, you know, why don't you get back in the Army and, you know, go over and do another tour? But, you know, he just can't. He's on disability, and he had to get out of the Guard. But, you know, it affects all of us. We can't do a lot of social things because he doesn't like the crowds, or he's just physically exhausted and can't handle it physically. And so that has led to isolation for me and a loss of social support for me. And, you know, the kids have been pretty good. You know, they were really young when he was gone. And my husband's been home for a while now, so we pretty much understand what this monster is that's in our lives.
Joyce, do you feel like you're getting any help?
Well, I've been able to reach out and get some help for myself. But it's been hard. I've lost some friends over it, and, you know, it's difficult. People just don't understand. I've got a great community of friends online who help me through this, and some friends in real life that, you know, that I interact with pretty frequently. I'm glad that the military is starting to notice this because, you know, you recruit a troop, but you retain a family. And if the family isn't going to get what it needs from the military, they're just going to go away.
Right.
I'm not saying that, you know, the military has been completely unhelpful, but I do wish there had been more available to me when he was still in the Guard. I just hope that other families can find more help and that other people will be more willing to reach out. It's scary to reach out. Some people will judge, and some people will make critical and nasty comments, but, you know, you just got to move past that and find somebody. You know, there are some great online communities if you can't find anybody, you know, in your everyday life. And I would just encourage people to reach out.
Yes. Well, Joyce, thanks so much for calling us and sharing your experience with us. Victoria Bruner, as the director of this program, do you have any advice for spouses like Joyce? What's out there? How many places are available in your program?
Our program currently is a pilot project, but I can assure you that there are many people who are very concerned. There is an organization of National Military Families, for example. There's the Association of the United States Army. There have been major policy initiatives, one by President Obama, Michelle Obama, and Dr. Jill Biden, called Strengthening Our Military Families, Meeting America's Commitment. I also think what Joyce is doing is most important, and that is that she is reaching out. She's gotten onto some social networks. There are some that are very, very helpful and very supportive. I think education is a key piece of what is important. I would encourage her, too, if they have a family physician, primary care physician, that they also discuss this with them and seek some support directly in the community from nonprofits, perhaps, even if they are in a religious community, to not keep it a secret, to help themselves by continuing to reach out. I can imagine that, and I'm going to put Sherry and Shamal on the spot, but I know it's not putting them on the spot, that they would be very willing, for example, and there are many other military spouses who would be willing to reach out to them, too.
Well, Sherry and Shamal, we're going to get back to you in a minute, but I wanted to ask you another question, Victoria. One of the things that you talk about getting spouses to be more resilient. Resilience is a very important concept. Can you quickly tell us what you mean by resilience, and how do you train people to be more resilient?
Well, you know, people actually have tremendous strengths already, that many times when they're in the midst of a crisis in transition, they get overwhelmed. They forget what has gotten them through in the past. Our program actually focuses a great deal on helping them to get back in touch with their resilience, also to remind them of some ways that they can regulate their own stress reactivity, which is very important, to help them find connections again to themselves, the family, and community, and to be able to start telling their story and know that there are people who will listen to them deeply. Mm-hmm.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about PTSD and military spouses. We're joined this hour by two military spouses in a new program, the Spouses and Significant Others Support Group. Sherry Hall and Shamal Dancy, also by Colonel Charles Engel, the psychiatrist who set up the program, and Victoria Bruner, the program's director. But right now, I want to go to Mike, who's calling us from Colchester, Vermont. Mike, hello. You're on Point.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. Colonel, Victoria, I wanted to say that I think that the work that you're doing is right, absolutely necessary. I'm retired from the Vermont National Guard. Vermont just lost another fine soldier, a young man, 45 years old. And I
lost in combat or lost how?
War. No, he was, as a result of PTSD here at home.
Mm-hmm.
So what I think is going on is this gentleman didn't want to attend meetings, and there's a number of those. I don't believe that the message that the colonel has is making it down to the unit level. When these guys return into their units of 50 or 100 people, they shouldn't be left to drift. I believe that there could be a more proactive approach into forcing these gentlemen in a collective meeting so that they can see. You know, you can't make them talk, but if you bring them together, especially the National Guard units, the full-time Army people are definitely moving. These guys here, this is home, and when they come back from something like that, they still need to be brought back in. If they're brought back in with the same people they went, they're more apt to get them to talk, because I've seen a number of them where they'll get together and things will start to open up. I just think that if we keep losing people for something like this, then I don't believe that the message at the command is coming down far enough.
Okay, Mike,
strong enough.
Thanks for the call. Colonel Engel, I'm sure you've heard this before. Now, you've been dealing with, you've been working on PTSD programs for a long time. Before this program for spouses, you directed the Respect Mill program to provide screening and treatment for soldiers with depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. But this soldier says that the message is not getting down to the ranks. And of course, we're seeing soldiers who are being asked to deploy for a fourth or fifth time. Is there adequate attention to those soldiers who are in danger as a result of PTSD?
Well, the short answer to your question is no. But let me just double back and also say that I'd like to acknowledge Joyce's comments earlier and thank her, you know, and really to Sherry and Shamal as well, and Mike, all of them, all the callers, for their courage and, you know, stepping forward and getting on the line and talking with us. You know, I want to thank them for their service. And, you know, I'm in airports around the country, sometimes in uniform. I get people thanking me for my service. I don't know that they get thanked for their service very often. So, you know, I really would like to thank them for their service. I agree wholeheartedly with this notion that we have to be using a more proactive approach, that it's not getting down to the ground level, if you will. And, you know, Respect Mill is one way that we've tried to reach out to service members, and increasingly we're moving towards using that program to reach out to families as well. You know, this is a program where we're setting up primary care clinics so that they are asking the right questions when people come in and about, you know, whether they're doing okay. And we get a lot of folks that tell us that, you know, they may come in once, twice, three times, four times, five times, 10 times and say no to those questions. But then, you know, one day they decide, you know, they're going to let their guard down a little bit and take, you know, take a step. You know, the beauty of trying to reach into primary care to reach out to soldiers is that, you know, these soldiers and their family members are all coming for care. You know, if you wait till they go to see a mental health provider, you know, only about, 15 to 20%, even in these days of relatively high mental health utilization in the military, will come to see a specialist each year among our beneficiaries, family members and soldiers. But if in terms of primary care, you know, we're talking about people coming in on average about 3.5 times a year. So You know, one way of reaching out to them is equipping the service system to ask the right questions of everybody that comes in and really holding the service system accountable, you know, through the collection of data to ensure that not only are they asking those questions, but when people raise their hand and say, yes, I have problems, that they're getting connected up with the services that, that they need. And that's, you know, that's one of the big goals of Respect Mill.
I want to bring Sherry and Shamel back into this conversation because we are mostly focused today on the special issues that spouses of service members with PTSD are facing. Sherry, what did this, did you, do you feel that this support group helped you, and how did it help you?
I absolutely feel like it helped. It helps you to better understand what PTS is, and it, that in turn helps you to better understand how your how you can help your soldier handle it. It's not something that goes away for them. Even though Jeff has been in the healing process for almost 3 years now, we still have days. We have up and down days, and this program kind of better helps the spouse to understand what their soldier's going through and how they can help their soldier by, you know, learning some of the things like the yoga nidra and the breathing techniques and all of those things that, you know, that helps to keep everybody calm in a situation. And it also gives you a chance to talk to other spouses about what they're going through and let them know, again, that they're not alone, that you're dealing with some of the same things. This is how I handled that, you know, and you just kind of learn from each other.
Shamel, what was the single best thing that you got out of this program?
I think it was great to know that I wasn't the only one that was going through the situation. Again, it's hard when you don't have that support system and you don't know anyone that's going through what you're going through, and to actually come from Fort Riley and meet Sherry and know that she was in my area, and then meet another spouse that's in my area, and just to know that other people are experiencing the same things that I go through on a daily basis was very important for me. And it made me feel that what I was feeling had some value to it, and I wasn't the only one.
Now, Victoria, what we're hearing here, the importance of just getting women to connect with each other or learn yoga or breathing techniques, this does not sound like a real complicated, expensive program. I mean, it must be actually a pretty inexpensive program. Why is it still operating on such a small scale?
Well, you know, I think that we pulled upon the community in order to make this happen. We actually worked hand in hand with several nonprofits and the community, Project Cause, the Walter Reed Society, Operation Brave Families, volunteers, etc. It is simple in its concept. The more that we talk about this as we are today, the more folks that we have, such as Sherry and Shamel, who can go out and discuss this and actually take the model. This is our hope, that this is just one model and people can take it themselves and replicate that in their own communities. Tom, if I may, I do want to double back to Mike. Because the issues of the reservists and National Guard members are so prominent in their families, that you know, I would encourage him and other members of the National Guard to contact their National Guard Bureau. There are programs that are available. There are new initiatives that are actually placing clinical social workers in each state National Guard just to address issues and to hear that what the concerns are and to listen.
You know, I want to reemphasize, repeat, that we're going to have some links on our website pointing to resources for families who are dealing with these issues. We have one listener on Facebook, Mary Jo, who says, my son is suffering from PTSD and is in Fort Hood, Texas. Where can I get help for him here in Buffalo? So we do have people. We have a Mark Van Patten, who also has written into Facebook saying that Fort Campbell, Kentucky is doing wonderful work through a private contractor to provide many, if not all, of the services your guests describe. It's sad the National Guard does not have any access to these services. I think it's very important for listeners who are looking for help yourselves to know where some of these resources are. And we can start by by providing some of those links on our website. I want to go now to Sandy from Solon, Ohio, Iowa. Sorry, Sandy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I'd like to make just one comment. First, I'm in near Iowa City where we have a VA hospital, and they have meditation for participants, people who want to come in, returning soldiers, that's available. And I care for my World War II dad, and it's even available to him. And in the VA facility hospital there, they have acupuncture available also. And I don't know how effective these are for returning soldiers, but great programs. Right. What I called about was to say, I was 4 days back from Vietnam and married him, and in the first year...
I'm sorry, Sandy, your line is breaking up. You must be calling on a cell phone, which often produces some problems. I think that you were going to, I understand you were going to talk about your husband who had PTSD and what became of that. In terms of your relationship. Victoria, quickly to you, to what extent do you see relationship issues as really rising to the forefront as families deal with PTSD? I mean, we both Sherry and Shamal have been very open about issues that they had with their husbands. I mean, I'm sure that this is very common, that you get real serious relationship issues.
Well, that's right, because... you know, the separation itself is difficult. If there were difficulties in the relationship beforehand, they just don't magically go away. Many people may think that after deployment, the service member and their family will have a honeymoon period and everything will return to normal. But in fact, that's not going to happen. There is an adjustment in any deployment. And you have to come back to a new normal. And so the strain is really on the parents, in many cases, with the children. The children have also suffered through the deployment. We have many more women now in the military who are leaving their children behind with family members. But relationships are always critical in addressing, and we actually address that issue in the educational modules that we have in our program.
Good. James is calling us from Lebanon, Illinois, with a story of his own to tell us. James, you're on Point. Welcome.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I just got out of the Shepherd Center in Atlanta, Georgia. It's an inpatient treatment center, but I was a Marine machine gunner in Iraq during the 7 months prior to the Fallujah offensive, received 3 Purple Hearts. I was shot a few times. And I lost a total of 28 really good friends. And the biggest thing to help me kind of move past my PTSD, I still suffer from it, but was the Subconscious Reconstructuring Institute. It is kind of changing your thought pattern so you're not always stuck in the past. It's kind of changing self-talk you do to yourself and always thinking about what can I do to empower myself for the future and trying to learn about everything you went through and kind of just internalize and say, hey, you know, I went through these things. It made me a better person. Now how can I take everything that I have absorbed and kind of put it into helping other people and moving basically forward in civilian life?
James, are you married?
Actually, I was married, but due to 5 years of me suffering PTSD, we ended up getting a divorce.
And do you want to talk about that, how that affected your relationship with your wife?
Yeah, for 5 years, you know, I was in the hospital for 8 months recovering from my wounds. And I was basically numb to the world, didn't feel any emotion, didn't want to talk to anybody, isolated myself, cut myself off, turned to pot and alcohol to deal with, you know, the death of my friends, almost the death of myself quite a few times. And, you know, that just kind of led to a destructive anger, really bad emotion towards everybody and everything, destroyed every relationship I had. And that kind of just led to, you know, my divorce. You know, I wasn't the person that I went to Iraq from when I came home. I was a completely different person. But now I feel like I'm back to the person I was before I left.
Well, good for you for seeking the treatment that you need and that so many other soldiers and their family members need. And thanks for calling. We have just about a minute left. Very quickly, some final thoughts. Shamel Dancy, do you have any advice for other women like you?
I would just try to stay positive and optimistic about your husband's PTSD. I've come to realize that the man I married is gone, but I feel that we can build from here with the right resources and support. And just reach out and get the help that you need, not only for your spouse, but for yourself.
And Sherry?
I totally agree with what Shamel just said. There are numerous resources out there for families. And there's also resources out there for Guard and Reserve families as well. Those are the ones that I really look, you know, I really see a lot of struggle with them, too. But learn as much as you can about PTS and how you can help your soldier deal with it.
Shamel Dancy and Sherry Hall are spouses of soldiers who have been dealing with PTSD. They joined us from Fort Riley, Kansas. Victoria Bruner is the director of the military's new pilot program, the Spouse and Significant Other Support Group. It's for spouses and family members of servicemen and women affected by PTSD. And we didn't talk about this, but Victoria lost her own husband in Vietnam. And finally, Colonel Charles Engel. He is the founder of the Spouse and Significant Other Support Program, and he is a psychiatrist and director of the Deployment Health Clinical Center at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. Before setting up this program for spouses, he directed the Respect Mill program to provide screening and treatment for soldiers with depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. Sherry, Shamel, Victoria, Colonel Engel, thanks so much for joining us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And as I said, we've put some links to resources for service members and families dealing with PTSD up on our website. And you can follow us, of course, on Twitter and on Facebook. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.